Earth for granted since we see it every day. It is part of life's background. But when you see the world through the eyes of science, nothing is mundane. We live on the surface of this great, giant, space-borne, water-laden, spinning rock, separated from the rest of the universe beneath a thin veil of nitrogen and oxygen molecules. Even though we're immersed in its influence, what do we really know about the Earth? With us today during this week of Earth Day is Dr. Gregory Mayer of UW Parkside, a scientist and professor who carefully and methodically and without bias studies the available information about our Earth and then teaches students about the science of our world. Among those scientific realities is a growing topic of interest, climate change, the impact that it has, and its implications for the future of our planet. Thank you so much, Greg, for joining us today.
Well, you're welcome. I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
I was so pleased you could come. Let's begin with one of the most obvious questions, I guess. Despite the debate over the years, is there really climate change? And what's the scientific consensus on that? What do scientists believe?
The climate is changing. It's getting warmer. The last decade or so has been among the warmest, if not the warmest, in history. In fact, 2014 is the warmest year in the over now 130, 140-year record, instrumental temperature record that we've had. 2010 was the second warmest. Of the 10 warmest years ever in the instrumental record, all have been since 1998. So the climate is warming up.
And would you say scientists in general are in pretty strong consensus that there is?
Yeah, this is a well-known fact. There's no doubt about it.
And global warming is another word we use.
That's right. I mean, then the major reason it's called global warming is that these records of temperatures are based on global or continental scale measurements, not at any one particular place, but basically the whole planet. And so the temperatures have gone up noticeably. In the last, it's mostly been since 1850. The instrumental records, I said, goes back to about 1880. But we can have other ways of discerning what the temperature was in earlier times from various records. And this increase in temperature has been since about 1850 mostly, corresponding actually reasonably closely to the Industrial Revolution and the consequent production of lots of carbon dioxide, which is one of the results of clean burning. When you clean a fuel, burn a fuel cleanly, you get carbon dioxide and water, which are normal components of the atmosphere, but you can get too much of a normal component, and that's what's basically happened with carbon dioxide.
Okay. And the people, even some scientists, not very many, that debate this, their argument is that the cause isn't carbon dioxide buildup, that it's natural fluctuations.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue again. Suppose you could argue that there are some natural changes, something other than carbon dioxide is causing the change in temperature. But that's a really hard argument to make because the physics of greenhouse warming is extremely straightforward. Mm-hmm. It's a very simple scientific principle. Radiation from the sun that hits the Earth is radiated back into the atmosphere. And greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and there are others, are gases that then absorb that radiation and radiate it back. They trap the heat in. So it's an easy effect. That's why it's called the greenhouse effect, because that's what greenhouses do. Mm-hmm. The sunlight comes through the greenhouse roof, which is clear glass. And without the glass, it's reflected off the surfaces and then would leave the greenhouse. But it can't get back through the glass again.
Okay.
And so the carbon dioxide acts in much the same way as the glass. It doesn't let the heat back out, and so it warms up again. So it's a very straightforward physical principle as to why increased carbon dioxide leads to warming.
So this is really a man-made, a human-made phenomenon.
Yes, because the increase in carbon dioxide in the last 100 and 150 years has been due to burning, for fuels, for factories, for lighting, for all sorts of things, all those many sources of energy. And I should say fossil fuels, because it's the burning of things like oil and coal. Now, burning wood also produces carbon dioxide. Those are not fossil fuels. Only energy sources like, say, hydroelectric power, solar power, wind power, those do not produce greenhouse gases.
Okay.
But, of course, although hydroelectric power has been used significantly for many, many years, centuries even, it's what's changed is that we now use a lot of fossil fuels that are burned, and those produce carbon dioxide when burned.
Okay. As a scientist, are you surprised that the debate kind of continues? I know there was a senator who came to the Senate with a, or maybe a representative who came with a snowball and said it proved that.
Right. As a scientist, I am surprised, but not as an observer of,
okay,
of
human nature.
Human nature. there are many people who deny the obvious because I forget who said this. It's very hard to get a man to see the truth when his livelihood depends upon him not seeing it.
Okay.
So if denying the facts is profitable to you, it's very easy to deny
okay.
the facts.
Because a surprising thing to me is that it's become such a political issue, because when Earth Day started, that was a bipartisan thing, as I understand. I'm just amazed by the polarization, since the Earth and its future is so intrinsically interwoven with our own futures and our children's futures. So you would think that it would, I'm surprised that it's political.
Yeah, and again, as I say, it's hard. I think that it's hard to get a man to see the truth when not seeing it is profitable to him.
Mm-hmm.
I think that explains an awful lot of it. It's losing money. To admit the truth would be to admit that you'd have to do something that would cost you money. If you don't want to spend money, then you don't admit the truth.
Yeah. I know there was, this was 2 years ago that I wrote an article about global warming, but the headline was, "This is not good," and it listed that at least 7,775 weather stations across the nation reported breaking all-time high temperatures for the month, that particular month.
Yeah. And Australia, even more so, there was a number of, even made in the American media, where they ran out of colors to show how hot it was, where they had
a scale where
blue was the temperatures were below normal and red it was above. They kept getting redder and redder and redder, and they had to change the color scheme to express how hot it was getting in Australia.
We were talking before the show about internationally the countries, and I was kind of surprised. You want to tell our listeners?
Sure. The largest greenhouse gas producer is the United States. the second largest is China. Then come some other countries that combine both at least a certain level of industrialization plus large population, Russia, India, places like that. That's by no means an exhaustive list. But per capita, that is per person, the greatest is the United States, and second is Australia. And Australia is noticeably above places like the UK, where you might think, a fairly high Western standard of living is shared by, the U.S., Britain, Australia, and that's true. But for whatever reason, I'm not sure of the details, we do more of it in the U.S., and the closest to us and quite a bit above the third place is Australia.
Yeah, I was surprised by Australia.
Well, it's a high standard of living. It's a large country. They need cars to get around. They've got big houses like we do. In the data set I was looking at, I don't think Canada was in there, so I'm not quite sure where Canada would fall on the per capita, since the standard of living in Canada is in many ways similar to that in the United States. But I don't know what the figure is for Canada. But of the countries I saw, data for, the U.S. was number one, and Australia was getting up there with us.
And, I had asked you about why then, when you see in China so often you see them wearing the gas masks, but that's just because they don't.
That's a different sort of a thing. When you have soot and particulate matter, which is what those masks are especially good for, that's actually from incomplete burning. Masks don't prevent you from protect you from carbon dioxide. And indeed, carbon dioxide in small quantities is not toxic. I mean, you can't breathe the carbon dioxide atmosphere; that would kill you. But the small amounts, even the increased amounts, the effect is not from direct toxicity, but from its effects on the climate is why. Increased carbon dioxide is bad. So in China, the reason why they wear those masks is for their pollution controls are just not the same as they are in the West in general. And so you have soot and other particulate matters, which those masks, in fact, can help protect you from breathing in.
Okay. And Dr. Meyer, what are some of the things that we see physically and that give evidence of climate change?
Well, the most direct evidence, of course, is the temperature records themselves, but you can see it in the effects. For example, in mountainous regions, Switzerland, there are mountainous regions in the tropics, the glaciers are retreating. The glaciers are retreating quite rapidly in some places, in fact.
And if somebody said to you it doesn't matter, what difference does it make if the glaciers retreat?
Well, that's the question of, well, what's the problem if the Earth warms up in general? You could like glaciers and therefore miss. The Swiss, for example, I think would greatly regret if they lost their glaciers. It might have a negative effect on their tourist industry. Not to mention the fact that the melting of the glaciers then causes a lot of erosion in the farmland that lies in the valleys below the glaciers. And climates have changed greatly over the history of the Earth, even before there were people, of course. And for the last million years or so, we've gone through several ice ages, periods of great cold and then warming, mostly for astronomical reasons, not from carbon dioxide fluctuations, but from fluctuations in the axis of rotation of the Earth. So you could say, well, over time the climate's changed. What does it matter if it changes now?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the answer is that we've adapted to this climate. We've set up our society. We've set up our way of life around the climate that we have now. Now, if the climate changes slowly, we can slowly adapt to it, and there's not that much problem. But when climate changes rapidly, then it can be hard to adapt to it. One thing, for example, you say, well, what's the problem if the glaciers melt? Well, it's not so much that the glaciers are melting in terms of, because, say, the Swiss might not like it, but the Arctic ice pack is melting. And also, as the sea gets warmer, there's thermal expansion. When things warm up, they expand.
Uh-huh.
So the depth of the oceans are going up. Sea level is changing.
Right.
And if you look at an 18-foot increase in sea level, which is not how things are not moving that fast now. The rise in sea level over the last 100 years is in the order of like 10 inches or something like that. We're not talking like many feet. But 18 feet is enough to drown Florida south of about Orlando.
Isn't that amazing?
Miami is gone completely. Miami, yep. All the way up through Lake Okeechobee, you know, heading again on, not
right.
quite to Orlando, but the middle of Florida somewhere. You know, the southern part of the middle of Florida is lost. We saw a few years ago how hurricanes on the East Coast, Hurricane Sandy in New York, New Jersey, again, just a few feet of extra water coming in caused tremendous damage, tremendous economic losses due to losses of buildings, flooding into electrical works and that sort of a thing. So rise in sea level will cause problems. So you say, well, we'll lose the glaciers. But where does that water go? It's not so much the water in Switzerland, which will drain out, you know, through the Rhine or something into the North Sea. It's the ice pack melting into the North Sea and the sea in general. And the thermal expansion of the seawater, that'll cause great climatic, great problems for the people living on seacoasts. And most of the world lives on seacoasts.
Right.
You know, some of the countries in the Pacific, which are island countries, they'll essentially disappear. Places like Bangladesh, incredibly dense populations living very close to sea level. Where are those millions and millions of people going to go?
And habitats for animals, too.
And the animals
will
be gone, too. Polar bears, that's the thing, is that they have to depend upon ice packs for much of their way.
And that's currently
of
being
life.
Affected, isn't it?
Yeah, polar bears apparently are having to swim much further out now to reach the pack ice. Also, there's been increases, apparently, of interbreeding of polar bears and brown bears, because the polar bears can't make it out to sea anymore.
Okay.
And so they're hanging around more on the mainland. And so this is perhaps more of a curiosity than anything else, but they're starting to mate with the brown bears because they're being forced to stay on the mainland because they can't get out to sea because they can't swim that far. And they are great swimmers, but still it's beginning to affect them. And think of the crops.
Yeah.
Now, it might mean that parts of Saskatchewan and Alberta will open up for great farming country as they warm up. There, of course, Saskatchewan and Alberta already have a lot of farms. But it might mean that places like Texas and Kansas will dry up and not be places where you can do farming anymore.
Right.
Now, over the long term, could we adapt to having the breadbasket of North America move to be more in Canada than is in the United States? I suppose we could. But if it happens too fast, what are you going to do? It's like those people those millions of people in Bangladesh. You know, if this took hundreds or thousands of years, we could move slowly.
But and the weather effects, like you said, look at the tsunamis and the increasing weather effects.
Yeah, and it is important to distinguish weather from climate. I was in Florida recently with visiting some colleagues there, amongst other things, And I was speaking to a senior colleague, and he mentioned how, you know, so many people don't realize that weather is not the climate.
Uh-huh.
That is what has happened this winter. Say, oh, this winter was cold, this winter was warm. That's not the climate. The climate are these things averaged over at least decade, if not longer periods of time. There's no sort of hard and fast rule between what's there between weather and climate. But what affects your temperature or your precipitation or your particular season here and now, that's not weather. Sorry, that's not climate. That's the weather. Now, the climate does have an effect on weather in the sense that as things warm up, certain things will be more common. Certain things will become less common. Sometimes extremes increase. Sometimes extremes can go down. One thing in Wisconsin in particular is that, especially in northwest Wisconsin, there are many fewer days where the temperature drops below zero now because of the general warming. So that would be then perceived as weather as well, you know, in any particular season. Because surface water, the temperature of surface water, especially in the tropics, is a major contributor to the strength of hurricanes and similar cyclonic storms throughout the globe, there is at least the potential for a increase in surface water temperature to lead to larger storms.
And we certainly see this happening. I remember in Inconvenient Truth, when that came out, must have been over 10 years ago now, but saying it doesn't mean that it's just going to get warmer and warmer. It means all these, and they mention all the weather phenomena that could happen because of climate change.
That's right. Climate change is, although the general warming is a part of it, in some places it'll get colder, in some places it'll rain more, in some places it'll rain less. That will all depend upon the local circumstances. And we shouldn't be too fast in ascribing a particular storm to global warming.
Okay.
Because there's always been warm surface waters in tropical regions at particular times and places that can produce big storms. It's more, again, over a 10 or 20-year period.
I was going to say,
frequency go up? You don't want to say, oh, there was a big storm last year. You can't say that's global warming. But if there are, you know, 7 big storms a year over 10 years, as opposed to prior, there were 2 storms a year. A good example of that, not a weather-related phenomenon, but a geological phenomenon, is that just recently the Oklahoma Geological Survey finally admitted that the new oil drilling techniques, fracking that they introduced, is causing an increase in the number of earthquakes there. And again, you had to look at over a number of years. We can understand to a certain extent why they didn't immediately declare it. But there was an average of like 2 earthquakes a year in Oklahoma over many years. There's now an average of 2 a day.
Okay.
But that's been going on for some years now. You know, whether it's 10 years, I don't know the exact period of time since they introduced these techniques. But if 1 year the number of earthquakes shot up, who knows what caused that?
Mm-hmm.
It's only the consistency over time. And for climate especially, which is a many multi-year phenomenon, the average temperature, the average rainfall over significant periods of time. So we don't want to attribute a particular storm and say, oh, that's a global warming storm.
Right.
That would be the same as saying, oh, we had a cold winter, therefore there's no global warming. Any particular storm, any particular cold day, that's the weather. You need to look at what is the average over a longer period of time to get a climate.
And I think that's what some of us who are older and we've, you know, seen the news for decades now, it seems the frequency of storms, of tsunamis, of earthquakes, of even droughts and wildfires are affected, are they not?
Because drying, when the plants dry out, that provides the fuel for the fires. And, of course, the fires then produce more carbon dioxide, too.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of it's a self-reinforcing phenomenon.
And the droughts in California, the droughts, I know you can't relate a specific thing to, but I guess it.
Yeah, you'd need a longer time scale,
mm-hmm.
you know. And again, a human lifetime, you know, 100 years or six, 310 or whatever it was in the Bible, they said, was the time allotted to us. That's enough time to see differences from when you were a child to when someone becomes older. But you can't rely on your memory. Oh, gee,
right.
I don't remember storms like this when I was a kid.
Right.
Over a 50-year period, track, what are the changes in the number of storms? What are the changes in the number of wildfires? What is the changes in droughts? What is the change in rainfall? That then would reflect climatic change.
Mm-hmm.
So people do live long enough to see changes in the climate, but you need to look at it carefully. You need to sort of tally them up. You can't just rely upon your memory of storms, which is not to say your memory is faulty. It's just that you got to go back and look at the records.
Sure. And that's why the consensus of the scientific community on this is so important, because that's what you guys are
looking at. And they've gone back
at.
And looked at the records. You know, they're not relying upon...
They're not saying it's been a hot year.
Yeah, my grandfather told me when he was a kid they never had weather like this. That's not the that's not the basis.
You know, how are we doing with alternative energy sources? Is the wind, the solar power, the hydroelectric, is it... Is use of that as alternatives to carbon burning, is that helping us at all?
Well, any power that's generated from those sources can displace uses of power that would have led to the production of more atmospheric carbon dioxide. But it's clear in the U.S. anyway that we still use an awful lot of fuels, burned fuels, mostly fossil fuels. Wood, as I say, also produces carbon dioxide, but wood burning alone is a fairly minor source of energy these days. But solar and wind and others still remain largely minor sources of energy. In a few places, nuclear energy is clean, does not produce carbon dioxide, does not produce those sorts of things. So in countries like France, which rely very heavily on nuclear power, that may be one reason why I mentioned, for example, that Australia and the U.S. are high, but other Western countries with similar lifestyles don't, like France. France has an awful lot of nuclear power, which would tend to reduce their carbon output.
So alternative sources of energy is one important way that we have to move. What about vehicles?
Vehicles, again, would be alternative sources of energy. So there are now various kinds of electric cars, ones that are based on batteries. However, you have to look carefully, how are those batteries produced? If the batteries are produced with fossil fuels, then there's no actual save. You say, oh, my car's not burning any gasoline. But, well, how much gas, not how much gasoline, but how much fuel oil was burned to produce the batteries for your car? And I frankly don't know. But it can be very difficult to determine what one's carbon footprint, as it's called these days. That is, how much carbon do you consume, or are you responsible for producing? It's not just what you use. You know, say, well, my car doesn't burn much gasoline, or burns no gasoline at all.
But you have to look at everything.
You got to look at everything. The same thing with, you know, if you have a just even solar power. You say, well, my house uses solar energy. But how much energy is used to produce your solar panel? Now, in fact, I do believe that there's a net plus there, but you do have to look at that. So in some places, solar energy is increasing a lot. For example, in Hawaii, solar power has become so popular that the electric companies are beginning to resist it, because they're wondering how they're going to make money now.
Right.
And, of course, Hawaii is in the tropics. You got a lot of sunlight, and it's much more feasible there to use solar power as a major source. And in Hawaiian homes, as it is in many places, if you are a net electricity generator, the electrical supplier has to buy the energy back from you. That's part of the reason then they're becoming...
That's right.
They don't want to do that. And it also does produce problems with the flow through the grid, that they're getting energy at times they don't want or need it. Increasingly, I've read that Hawaiian homes now are putting in batteries so they can just disconnect from the grid and charge their batteries with solar power during the day and then use their batteries at night. As that spreads, that would be decrease the total amount of carbon dioxide being produced. And there's also ways of looking at then taking the carbon dioxide that's in the air and trying to remove it in some ways.
Is there research on converting CO2?
Well, plants, CO2 is a fairly, simple gas. I mean, you could chemically, combine it with other sorts of things. But you can also put a lot of carbon into plants. When plants grow, the carbon they get comes from carbon dioxide in the air. You might think that when you plant a tree, that the big mass that grows, that mass is growing up out of the soil, but actually very little in the way of nutrients come out of the soil, in terms of the actual mass of the tree. And there are very interesting experiments done many, many years ago, centuries ago, with potted plants to show, in fact, that the weight of the plant did not come from the pot. In fact, the weight of the plant primarily comes from the air. The wet weight includes a lot of water, but even if you dry it out, the weight of the wood, that's all carbon taken out of the air.
Wow.
So that's another way that you could reduce the amount of carbon in the air, by putting it back into plants.
So we kind of have to come to where we're doing things, well, individually, of course, but as internationally. And I don't know how are those international agreements.
Most of it, to do things, it really needs to be systemic. You know, what an individual's can do is somewhat limited. As I said, if you buy an electric car, that has limited effects, especially since you need a system whereby that vehicle could then be recharged at many places. Just as we have a system for fossil fuels, gas stations everywhere, we have a system that does that. For solar power in homes, we're beginning to develop a system whereby you could put one on a house and then connect to the grid or have batteries, but it's these systemic things. What you can do as an individual is fine, but it will perforce be limited in its effect unless it connects to a systemic thing. As I said, in Hawaii, where many, many homes now are going solar, batteries are becoming available. By making things systemic is how they get done. It's like recycling. It's when garbage companies and municipal waste pickup began dividing it. That's when recycling really becomes a factor in reducing waste and reducing landfills.
And that's where countries need to do those systemic things, but countries need to get together internationally and spread their technology. This time has gone so fast. I think this is my last question that we'll have time for. I do want to note, though, that in Earth Day this year, it's estimated that 1 billion people around the world took part in Earth Day activities. So that's pretty hopeful,
isn't
it? Yeah,
that's pretty good. You know, for the first Earth Day, since you mentioned that it was founded here in Wisconsin, but I was growing up in New York at the time. And so what I did for the very first Earth Day is I went to the woods at the end of my block. It was a small woods. And I cleaned it up. I picked up all the trash and garbage in the woods at the end of my block.
So you were a scientist as a young boy. That's amazing. I don't even remember the first. I mean, I'm sure I was around, but that's pretty impressive that you did that. So for my last question, you know, many people are very, very pessimistic about the future of our globe. And I know someone like that. He studied it a lot. He's young. And he says it doesn't matter because, you know, we're not going to survive. And actually, there's a prediction that the temperature will go up by 2 to 12 degrees by the end of this century. 12 degrees would be a lot and make
a
big difference. That would be a lot.
That would be a lot.
So I'm just going to ask you how optimistic or pessimistic you are about the future.
I don't see a lot of action at the moment. So if you were going based upon what's happening now, you'd be pretty pessimistic.
Okay.
There isn't a lot happening. But there have been times in the past when the politics have come together. So, for example, our water is a lot cleaner than it is than it used to be. You know, the rivers in Cleveland no longer catch fire. People no longer collapse on the streets of London from breathing the air, as they did 40 and 50 years ago. So if we could have a coming together of the political and social movements like that, there is a chance for taking real action. We've taken real action on things in the past, and it's worked out. We haven't taken real action on climate change, but maybe we will.
That is such a great summary, Greg. I can't thank you enough for being here. I wrote the following in an Earth Day article that's reprinted in my book. How we treat the Earth now for those yet to come matters a great deal. The Native Americans said it best, we do not inherit the Earth from our ancestors, we borrow it from our children. They understood implicitly that the gifts of the land and the water and the air are never really about ownership, but they are always about stewardship. I would like to thank our guest today, Dr. Gregory Mayer, a real hero in our midst who, like many others, is carefully and methodically studying our world and educating others about it. You do important work, and for that and for being here today, we thank you, Greg.
You're welcome.
And finally, thanks to you, our listeners, for sharing your time with us this Saturday. I'm Linda Fleshensky, and we hope that you go online at WGTD.org to hear this and other of our Heroes programs, and that you tune in to WGTD HD on the 4th and 5th Saturdays of the month at 10 a.m. for more editions of Heroes in Our Midst. We salute the hero in all of you. Take care.
Support comes from the Racine Symphony, closing out the season with a concert at the Racine Theater Guild Saturday evening with violinist Alex Jube, winner of this year's Young Artist Competition, playing Sarasate's Zagornerweisen. For tickets, visit racinesymphony.org or call 636-9285.
Support for WGTD comes from Vero International Cuisine in Racine on 6th Avenue near Monument Square.